This week on the show, Lindsey Bear of MLB.com breaks down the Red Sox-Yankees series from last weekend and talks about the AL East race heating up. And Aaron Torres of Fan Rag Sports joins us for a college football preview. All that and more coming up. Calling It starts right now. Welcome into Calling It. Alex Barth, Alex Leibowitz with you. The August 14th edition, coming off a big Red Sox-Yankees series, a big weekend in sports. Let's get right into it. Joining us on the phone from MLB.com is Lindsey Bear. Lindsey, how are you doing?
I am just peachy. How are you guys?
Doing well. You can't help but be excited after that series we saw this past weekend. When's the last time Red Sox-Yankees felt like this? It seems like it's been years that we have an actual rivalry between these two teams.
Yeah, like 2004 or something.
Right.
I don't. I mean, I'm sure you guys had more fun watching those games than us Yankee fans down here did. But that was some pretty entertaining baseball this weekend. How about that Devers home run last night? Right.
103 up and in the other way. I physically don't understand how he can do something like that.
I mean, I'm going to sound really bad here, and the Yankee fans are going to get mad at me, but when Chapman gets Hanley on three straight pitches or whatever it was, and that kid is in the on-deck circle, and he throws the same pitch three times in a row, and then Devers fouls off the same pitch, and he's on it, I'm thinking it's kind of time for a curveball, and then that doesn't happen, but I don't know what Chapman was thinking, and good on that kid for getting around on that, because that was fantastic.
Not to mention, it's a lefty-on-lefty matchup, which was really tough. I want to ask you, who is a better young core, the Red Sox or the Yankees? You talk about Rafael Devers, Andrew Benintendi, Betts, Bogarts, and then on the other side, Sanchez, Judge. Which team has a better future ahead of them?
I mean, I don't know how anybody can say that. It's a lot of fun to watch both of these teams right now. Benintendi is just incredible. He keeps coming through, and I've loved Bogarts from the very beginning. But you got to love, you know, a lot of these kids that the Yankees are bringing up too, which means that this rivalry that we haven't really felt since the early 2000s is probably going to be around for the next decade, which is going to be a lot of fun for everybody. So it's a win-win.
Who is the real Aaron Judge, the guy we saw as the face of baseball before the All-Star break, or the guy we've seen since?
I feel like this is one of those things, like when a young kid really, I mean, obviously in New York, there's and in Boston as well, there's a lot of spotlight on these guys, but then they get put on the national stage, and the reality and the hugeness of that kind of gets to people. So you got to hope for Aaron Judge that he's just sort of getting used to the extra pressure, and that he'll get used to that and come out of it. I hope so, because the beginning half of the year was really fun to watch. Not that he's doing terrible right now, but he is having some growing pains here, it seems. But you got to go hope that the talent is there. You know, it didn't just evaporate. So there's something else going on there that hopefully he can get through.
And we're talking to Lindsey Bear of MLB.com. Lindsey, Aroldis Chapman, this series, not the greatest of outings, and it seems like every time he goes up against the Red Sox, most times I watch him, he kind of unravels. You saw in the World Series last year, wasn't the greatest pitcher with the Cubs. Do you think that he's kind of hyped? Where do you think he stands in regard as one of the better closers in the league?
I'm going to sound like negative Nancy here. I've never been super high on Chad, and I feel like the good his fastball is fast, but it is flat, right? It doesn't do a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the good hitters in baseball, they need to see it once or twice, or if you're Devers, once, and they get around on it. It's just a timing thing, right? Which he has more success when he works in the curveball, the slider, like some off speed stuff, just to keep people guessing. But he doesn't like to do that a lot, and I think, is it an ego thing? Does he just not know how to work the count? Is he not listening to his catchers? Like, you got to vary that up a little bit more, and I hate to say this too, but I think people sort of know what to expect with him, so there's really not a lot of fear, right? You see like a guy like Chris Sale, and like every now and then he kind of lets one go where you never quite know where he's going to go, and you're kind of afraid to dig in on him, and I don't really see that happening with Chapman anymore. So I'm not a huge, like, yeah, you know, yay, rah, Yankee fan as a reporter anymore, but they are still my team. And when Chapman gets in there, I'm nervous all the time.
With all the guys they've brought in the last couple years, including even this year at the deadline, is Chapman still the right guy for them in the ninth inning?
I think it's Betances. But again, I'm like the negative Nancy, so we got to let Joe Girardi make the decisions, right?
Do you think that could change at any point, and maybe Chapman, especially after this weekend, ends up being used outside of the closer role?
I mean, I think on paper that's what needs to happen, but I don't think that goes over well with Chapman, so I kind of don't see them doing it. They're paying him to be a closer. You know, it just a lot of this stuff becomes red tape, so I don't know that I see that happening.
Again, we're talking
regardless of whether or not it's the right decision.
Again, we're talking with Lindsey Barra of MLB.com. So we had Addison Reed get shelled in game one of the series. The Yankees come back there. Game two was the Red Sox blowout. And then last night, the Rafael Devers home run. Which one of these three games to you was the most telling about the way these two teams stand in relation to each other?
Oh, God. I hate these definitive questions. I don't know, the whole series with everything going back and forth, but, you know, it's like any given Sunday, it's any given second with these guys. It just depends who's, you know, and with any team. This is why we play the games, right? Like, I always hate making predictions. I'm like, I don't know, if I knew, we wouldn't have to play the game. it's you know, indicative of a lot of, you know, Red Sox-Yankee games over the course of history where you know, very smart, very wise, I think very cute man once said, it ain't over till it's over. That's why we keep going, right? But yeah, like the tide shifts, that's why these rivalries are so fun and everyone gets so wrapped up in them. And this weekend was definitely exciting. I mean, I thought they were out on Friday night and all of a sudden we're all glued to the TV set. And then, you know, in the blowout, the tone completely changes, but you're still sort of watching, thinking maybe they could come back because they did it before. And that's what keeps us, you know, coming back and keeps these series so compelling.
So how do you see the ALE shaping up through these last, you know, 6-7 weeks of the season?
Oh, God. I don't know. Now, what are they, the Yankees are 5.5?
Yeah,
back
I believe
now?
5.5, yeah.
I mean, that's hard.
And, I mean, they still got 7 games left against each other, too.
I know, which is crazy, and I mean, you got to think the Yankees can beat the Mets a couple of times in the next couple of days. Who are the Red Sox going right now? I didn't even look.
They got the Indians tonight, but then they host the Cardinals for a 3-game series.
I mean, that's not going to be easy either. Like, yeah. This is why we play the games, right? But I mean, the Yankees. I mean, if they get in a wild card race, I mean, that's going to be fun. The Indians just look really good too, though. I don't know.
Who do you think the second best team in the American League is besides obviously the Astros at number one? Who do you think the second best is right now?
Cleveland or the Sox? Maybe I don't know. I hate the definitive questions. Again, I really just think it's any given Sunday. Some nights the Indians are so good. Some nights the Red Sox are so good, and then the other nights they're just, you're like, who are these guys? Right? Houston's the only one that's been so consistent. You know.
So let me ask you this then: what do you think about this year? Because it seems different this year than it has been in the past. Why is this year, why are so many teams so hot and cold and so unpredictable?
I think the huge number of young players who are like adjusting to the pressure. And I also think that we're seeing a lot of really weird injuries, like, and repetitive injuries, like where, you know, Matt Holliday has been on the DL a bunch of times. Like, people are going in and out and the rosters are changing, so you're not getting that consistency. So I think it's a mix of that, the injuries and then the young kids getting used to what's happening. And the young kids also going deep into the season for the first time and dealing with fatigue and what it feels like to get around that, like, 130-game mark, you know.
You mentioned a lot of young players in the league, and baseball has been has people considered somewhat of a boring, stale sport? I personally don't. But with the young talent coming up, what do you think of where baseball is right now in relation to, say, 5 years ago or 5-10 years ago?
I mean, I think that it's more about, not necessarily the young kids getting in is really good, but we got to get some personalities in baseball. I mean, I remember reading that Jason Stark story on ESPN about how there's no real face of baseball. And as, you know, great as Mike Trout is, he's kind of lost out there in Anaheim. And there's nobody that really kind of owns that spotlight as the face of the league. And Aaron Judge was kind of a good, you know, coming into that role at the beginning of the season, and now we're not exactly sure, but it gives you know, the young fan base that we're sort of losing more of a crew that they can relate to, and that's great, and it's super exciting for all of us who love baseball to know that the next 10-15 years with this crop of guys is going to be really, really good. And then hopefully those stars, you know, bring some more young kids out of football and lacrosse and soccer and get them back into baseball, and we get that talent pool up again. But it is super exciting. And a lot of these teams, the Red Sox and the Yankees right now, especially with the homegrown talent, which is really cool too, to not have to see guys shopping around for talent at the deadline.
I got to ask you, your grandfather, along with being one of the greatest catchers of all time, was somewhat of a philosopher, had a lot of quotes. What is your favorite Yogi Berra quote?
Oh, more definitive.
Yeah, you got to narrow it down. I had his book when I was younger, so I've always been a fan.
I like the sort of existential ones, like the future ain't what it used to be, and if things were perfect, they wouldn't be. The one I've been telling people, again, like my favorites sort of change with the week and what kind of mood I'm in and what is applicable to my life, but the one that I've been telling people a lot lately that I don't think people have heard very much, there was a press conference in the late 50s when Mickey Mantle and my grandfather first became the pitchmen for Yoo-Hoo. And my grandfather always remembered it because there was a female reporter in the front row, which in the late 50s was a rarity to have a woman reporter. And she raised her hand and she said, "Excuse me, is that hyphenated?" meaning Yoo-Hoo. And he said, "Lady, it ain't even carbonated." So that's my current favorite right now.
Yeah, we're talking to Lindsey Barra of MLB.com. Lindsey will be playing the old-time baseball game on Thursday. Steve Buckley puts the game on every year in Boston. It's to raise money for charity. This year will be for ALS. I got that correct, right? ALS this year?
Yeah. ALS-TDI is the ALS Therapy Development Institute in Cambridge, and then it's also going to John Stevens directly, who is a Nesson cameraman who was just diagnosed with ALS.
So, Lindsey, I know you played last year as well, and you have a history with the game. How did you get involved, and what's it like for you to be able to get out and play in the game?
So Steve Buckley was harassing me for many years, telling me to come up there and play, and I was like a little afraid because I, at the time, was like a 36-year-old woman who hadn't played softball in like 15 years, much less baseball with active college pitchers, and I really just didn't want to get myself killed. So he said, "Yo, you can come up and just pinch run." And I was like, "Oh, sure, all right, I can do that." So I think this is my fourth year. The first 2 years, he had me in a Johnny Pesky uniform, which I'm not so sure how Yogi Berra's granddaughter ends up in a Johnny Pesky Red Sox uniform, but I rationalized it by saying that Grandpa always said Old Needle Nose was a good guy, so I guess it was all right. And then 2 years ago, he got me my own Grandpa Yogi uniform, which I wore last year, and I'm going to wear this year. And I think I'm going to stick with the pinch running. Pedro's pitching a little bit this year, so I think the guys are going to really be bringing it. And I'm not getting in the box against somebody throwing 92. So there we go.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. Pedro's starting. How much is fastball do you think he has left?
I mean, I don't think Pedro needs to have that much of it left because he can put it wherever he wants it. And I think he's going to make some people look pretty silly. It's going to be fun.
You can check out more information for that game on oldtimebaseball.com. You can follow Lindsey on Twitter, @LindseyBerra. Lindsey, thanks so much for coming on talking Red Sox Yankees with us.
Cool. We'll see you on Thursday night.
Colin, it is a Snap Call Sports production. Snap Call Sports is available for iPhone or Android download. Snap Call, the game within the game.
Welcome back to Callin' It. Thank you to Lindsey Barra talking some Red Sox Yankees, and we'll have more on the next series next weekend and the weekend after that. How great is this? 3 weekends in a row, Red Sox Yankees, tight division. Love it.
It's great. The rivalry's back. I feel like it's back. There might not be the hatred, but it's competitive.
It's getting there.
Yeah.
I think the Yankees fans hate Devers after last night.
There's definitely still hatred between the fans. And I want it to grow there because there's unlikable people on each side. You know, you have your Aroldis Chapmans, you have your David Prices, your Dustin Pedroias for some. Like, it should be back. I just want someone to throw at somebody else just to ignite it again, you know?
And you know what? It times out perfectly because right after that third series, which is, I believe, September 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, it's the first weekend of September, mm-hmm. then boom, Thursday, NFL football regular season. So we are like, we're chock full going right up.
We're here. We're like, we're at the doorstep right now for like when sports gets great.
You have, after the quiet period in February, you have spring training, March Madness, you know, that whole role, yeah. NFL draft. This is kind of the fall equivalent of that. After having nothing, we're going training camp, good MLB pennant race, which you don't always have. And then we're going to get right into NFL football. And then of course the NBA and the NHL, but let's get into some NFL football right now. preseason week one in the books, finished up last night. Did you watch any, before we get to the Patriots, did you watch any of the Chargers game? I forget who they were playing.
No, on NFL Network.
They're playing in that soccer stadium. That's going to be an unmitigated disaster.
It's like 30,000 fans.
It's tiny. It's terrible.
But that would be fun to watch a game there, right?
But it's, because it's a soccer stadium, the seats are further away. It might be. It wouldn't be fun to, that's a garbage team.
Oh, no, yeah. Like, I'm just saying, like, atmosphere-wise, like, it would get loud. I don't know. Maybe I'm stretching.
If they have any fans out there. But Patriots preseason game earlier this week, Pats against the Jaguars. And some, you know, kind of what you want from a preseason game. A lot to be positive about, but still a lot to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Who's your, let's go three ups, three downs. Give me three ups for you from that preseason game.
Three ups? I think Garoppolo looked pretty good. Yeah. I think you had a bunch of guys, a lot of wide receivers who stepped up, who you're not expecting to maybe make the roster. A guy like Austin Carr, Hollison. It seemed like there was a few guys who stepped up from a skills position standpoint. Besides that, I don't know. I thought it was a preseason game. You get some garbage time players, but I like Garoppolo. I think he looked pretty good. I think we know what we're going to get out of him.
Right.
And the wide receiver, Austin Carr, again, just a guy who was undrafted. He seems like he's going to make the team. He's someone who's like a prototypical Patriot, someone Bill Belichick's probably had his eye on. So those are the two guys I'd say that really stuck out.
My ups for me, I'm not going to put Garoppolo on the list because I thought he was shaky in the first half. I loved how he responded, and credit to Bill Belichick for putting him back out there. And that's my first up is Bill Belichick. He made the right move, putting Garoppolo back out, giving him the extra reps that he needed. And he sat a league high 40 players during that game. He kept them healthy. I think there was one injury. It was Dietrich Wise had a concussion. Was, I think, the only injury.
Yeah.
He kept them healthy. So Bill Belichick's a major up for me. And then, like you said, Austin Carr absolutely balled out. He's going to make it very difficult for Belichick to keep him off this team. Especially, we don't know what Malcolm Mitchell's situation is. He's still on PUP. He still hasn't practiced. Does he start the year on PUP? If you're comfortable enough with Austin Carr. And then I thought Hollister. He has, between him and Carr, I think he has a better shot because you do need a third tight end. And Langold not playing, O'Shaughnessy not playing, that really helped him. Three down. Another up for me, actually, I just want to throw in real quick, is Harvey Lange, because you did two, so I'll get four. Harvey Lange, undrafted linebacker out of BYU. $110,000 of guaranteed money. That's the largest given to a UDFA this year by any team. And he was around the ball on almost every play. He played most of the game. He was involved. He could be, especially if Landon Roberts takes a step back from last year, which some people are saying it looks like he will, based on what's happened in camp. Lange could be an important player for them. I thought he looked really good. Three downs, or do we only need one?
I have two.
You have two, okay.
There's Cyrus Jones. Right. I think that's the obvious
one. Well, there's
one.
Cyrus Jones, the corner, and Cyrus Jones, the kick returner.
Both. and Gostkowski. Both those guys are down.
Yeah.
That kick, and the reason I say Gostkowski is because the reports are he did that twice in the previous week leading up to that game. He did that twice, that same knuckleball-type kick. I know it was a really – what was it? It was at least 50 yards, 51, 57, something like that. But it just didn't look right.
We've seen him hit that.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not a kicking expert, but it looked awkward.
Are you surprised they didn't bring another kicker into camp to compete?
Yes,
because I thought they were going to draft somebody.
Yeah,
I really did.
I am surprised, and I think the only thing that saved him is his kickoff. Like as a kicker from a standpoint of kicking off, he's one of the best in the league.
Right.
I think he's amazing at
it. He can pin the ball right at the one, but some people think that's what threw off his field goal ability.
Maybe
he had to change his mechanics.
Maybe. If it wasn't for that, I don't think he'd be on the Patriots. He's clearly taken a step back as a straight-up place kicker. But I don't know. I think he's a Belichick favorite. He figures he has one more year. Maybe he doesn't value that position as much as others, and he didn't think it was worth it as another talking point in the media.
I will say this. I don't think Belichick cares about the talking points in the media. I think if he thought he needed a better kicker, he'd bring in a better kicker. Even years where there hasn't been a competition, he brings in an extra kicker just to have the extra body at camp. If you're doing a drill where you need two different drills or you need two kickers, it helps to have that guy. They brought a kicker from UMass in like 3 years in a row.
Yeah.
But I'll say this. I was doing some research on the 2007 preseason, and he was 5-for-9 that year, including 1-for-3 in a game against Carolina. And then he had a typical pre-struggle Gostkowski year. He was great. So he missed, but if he hadn't had the struggles he's had the last few years, we wouldn't be talking about it.
I think one thing's for sure.
That being, I am worried, but
yeah,
just for context.
If I was a betting man, I'd say this is his last season.
I would think. And it's the last year of his contract, too, I believe. So, you know, it would make it easy. I thought they were going to take somebody in the draft this year to have that 1 year to groom him, mm-hmm. keep him on the practice squad. But, you know, we'll see. Look at Robert Aguayo. Like, it's tough. It's clearly tough to evaluate kickers. Aguayo didn't miss inside 35 yards in college. He came out, he was trash.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
And he was a first-round pick, right?
Second-round pick. Him and Cyrus Jones were picked back-to-back.
Unless you're Sebastian Janikowski, and even there, I don't think it's worth it to be picked that high.
Al Davis, baby.
Kickers should not be taken within the first 5 rounds, in my opinion. But
I would honestly take a punter before I take a kicker, to be honest.
Yeah, maybe. I think they're pretty much equal.
Ray Guy changed the Raiders' defense. And now Ray Guy's the greatest punter of all time. It's not even close, but Ray mm-hmm. Guy was the best defensive player on the Raiders when they were a dominant NFL team.
Yeah.
Because if the other team's going, you know, 95 yards instead of 75 yards, that's a game changer.
Absolutely, yeah.
Cyrus Jones, real quick. I know I was in on him last week. I've been in on him for a year. I am out. I am done. The guy can't play. Get him out of here. He's got David Price brain. It's not going to change. The lights are too bright. I think he'll make the team just because the way the salaries work out, but I'm done with him.
Yeah, I. It's shocking, though. Of all the people you expect to make the transition into a Patriots-like atmosphere, given all the media and the attention, you'd think it'd be an Alabama product. But he's come in. He was the first pick for the Patriots last year, and he hasn't done anything. He's been awful. And it is mental. You know, he made mistakes in the game on Thursday, and then he didn't speak to the media. Like, if you're gonna
sounds familiar,
yeah. If you're gonna crap the bed, so to speak, you gotta face the music. He didn't do that.
Right.
He didn't do that. He left. And I think that reflects poorly on him. I think you can look at that and link that to maybe his attitude. So I don't know. They drafted him thinking he'd be a punt kick returning specialist, maybe another cornerback. He hasn't done any of those things.
Belichick's history of picking second round corners. Is a who's who of Rozai Dowling,
brutal.
Darius Butler, and Terrence Wheatley. And then you can add Cyrus Jones to that. Meanwhile, undrafted.
He's been great.
Malcolm Butler, Cravon LeBlanc, Sterling Moore. He's knocked it out of the park. So,
yeah.
You know, Belichick, day four guy when it comes to corners. One more NFL thing I want to touch on, and, you know, we could get into more Patriots stuff. We'll do that next week. Ezekiel Elliott, 6 games. Alleged. Is it? What's the term? Because it's not alleged because there was no case.
No,
I don't know what the legal term is. Accused of, I guess accused of.
It's alleged because someone alleges that he did it.
But not anymore.
There's still evidence. Well, they interviewed the victim.
Okay.
Of the domestic abuse. But I've also seen things on Twitter where there's text messages saying that she's trying to ruin him just for the sake of doing that. She's crazy. I don't know. All I know is the guy has made mistakes before. You can talk about that parade where he pulled that woman.
If you go back and watch the video of that, because that was interesting. She go like, there's a second video that's recorded right after where she swats his hand away and then pulls her own shirt down.
Still, you're.
It's Mardi Gras. Like, not that it's right, but it's Mardi Gras. If he's a third string running back, I don't think any attention gets paid to that. And
if he's a third-string running back, he's cut. That's what I think.
The thing for me, and look, did Ezekiel Elliott screw up? Yes. He's not at all a victim in this case. He did wrong, and he deserves to pay the consequences. But that being said, Josh Brown last year, a kicker for the New York Giants, admitted that he thought of his wife and his kids as his slaves, and that really just messed up. Effed up diary he had. I don't know if you read.
Yeah,
so I
know.
Saw
yeah,
some
I
of that. You can look it up if you want. And he got one game.
Mm-hmm.
And it had nothing. He admitted to it. And he got one game. But the Maras have always stuck by Roger Goodell. Always.
Well, let me ask you this, because this changes a narrative right now. You have Jerry Jones. This has been talked about before. You have Jerry Jones, who backed up Goodell when he handed down that 4-game suspension to Brady. Now the tables turn.
Well, what people aren't talking about, he not went after Goodell. He gave a little bit of attitude when Elliott got fined for jumping in the Salvation Army pot.
Yeah.
And I think it's literally a case right now of, you know, you don't put King Roger in your shadow. Whoever you, whether you're Jerry Jones, Ezekiel Elliott, Tom Brady, you don't put Roger Goodell in your shadow. Josh Brown was never going to outshine Roger Goodell. He didn't care. Ezekiel Elliott, this guy's becoming too big of a name. Nobody's bigger than the Shield. You know, let's slap 6 games on him. I'm just asking for some consistency. Either give Josh Brown 6, which is the right answer, or give Ezekiel Elliott 1 game, which is the wrong answer, but at least it's consistent.
Yeah.
That's all I'm asking for, is a little bit of freaking consistency.
Well, they haven't been. At all. Like any punishment, there's so many times that the NFL has contradicted themselves or just been extremely inconsistent with punishment, or just been extremely harsh, or vice versa. They haven't been harsh enough. So I look at that, and I don't know. I think that's the biggest problem for the NFL is punishment, and it all goes back to PR, how they think this is going to affect the league from a PR standpoint, and that shouldn't be at the forefront. The reality is...
But don't they have to understand at a point that it's bad PR to give out these inconsistent suspensions?
Oh, I agree. I'm not going to feel bad for Ezekiel Elliott for getting the 16.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't feel bad for him, but the league ultimately comes out looking worse than he... They took a guy who's an alleged domestic abuser, mm-hmm. and made him look like a victim. Not that he is, but they made him look like one. What does that say about the NFL?
They're horrible at managing these issues. Yeah, it's terrible. I think the one thing this does point out is that Josh Brown should have received a harsher punishment than he did get. And Ezekiel Elliott, that's probably what he deserves. I think he's a kid who feels like he's invincible. He was... a standout at Ohio State. He's known nothing but success. People love him. Everyone tells him he's great. And he feels like he can do anything. And when that happens, you're a little careless. He needs to realize he has a platform. He's famous. And that he can't be doing these things he's doing like he did at that Mardi Gras right. parade. Even if this is not true, I think this is a wake-up call for Ezekiel Elliott.
I think it's just all about the kind of player you are. Because who is it? Muhammad Wilkerson going 120 with a baby and a loaded gun in the car? Got 1 game?
He was smoking pot. He had a loaded gun. He was going 120 with his 12-year-old nephew in the car.
And he got what? 1 game? 2 games?
He got maybe 2 or 4 games, something like that. Exactly. I think his 4 went down to 2.
But he's not Ezekiel Elliott. He's not Tom Brady. And that's suspension shouldn't be based on star power. That's the problem.
So there's inconsistency, and it's prejudice towards skill position guys, towards quarterback.
Well, not just skill position, but how big of a talent, how much of a talent you are.
Yeah.
I think even, you know, it would be different. Even the Josh Brown thing.
If it was J.J. Watt, it would be
different. Right, even the Josh Brown thing would be different if it was, you know, Justin Tucker.
That's true, yeah.
But, you know, you think Zeke gets the full 6, he's going to appeal.
No, I think it'll be taken down to 4 or 3.
I think it's going to... Well, look, the Cowboys play the Packers week 5 in a rematch of that playoff game, and...
The NFL's going to want
Zeke. Yeah, they're going to want Zeke in that game. They gave him 6 so they could move it down. All right, we've talked a lot of NFL football on the show the last couple of weeks. We don't at all want to ignore college football. On the other side, Aaron Torres. We'll take a look at the preseason polls, a little college football preview for y'all. We'll be right back.
Colin, it is a Snap Call Sports production. Snap Call Sports is available for iPhone or Android download. Snap Call, the game within the game.
Welcome back into Calling It. We've talked a lot of NFL football, but as close as we are to the NFL, we're that much closer to college football season. Time for our college football preview, and joining us on the phone, you can find him on FanRag, you can find him on Fox Sports Radio, is Aaron Torres. Aaron, how are you doing today?
Fellas, I'm doing well. How are you guys doing today?
Doing good. Getting that much closer to college football. I have my tickets. I will be down there in Georgia for Alabama FSU. Now, what are the chances? We already got one poll has them at 1-3. What are the chances we see an AP 1-2 matchup in Georgia to start the season between Florida State and Alabama?
First of all, I'd love to know how much you spent on those tickets. I won't dare ask, though.
I got a cousin who works for Florida State football. I got the connection.
Okay. Oh, my goodness.
I lucked
out.
Okay,
excuse me. Excuse me, big timer here. We got the big ballers. I thought the big ballers were on the West Coast. I guess not, though. So to answer your guys' question, it's actually really funny because, as you just alluded to, I've been doing a lot of writing for FanRag, and literally right before I got the phone with you, I put together what I consider to be my top 25, and I actually have Alabama, Florida State 1-2. You know, look, I think the pollsters, when the AP poll comes out next week, I think 1-3 is realistic. I think a lot of people like Ohio State. I'm not as sold that they can kind of get it done on the offensive side of the ball. But I think you're going to see 1-2, 1-3, 2-3, something in that capacity. But these are two of the very, you know, absolute premier teams in college football. And it's funny because a lot of times, you know, you see the kind of name brand programs, you know, dueling in week one, and, you know, it doesn't end up being what we expect it to be. You know, last year USC played Alabama week one, and USC was a disappointment early before coming on late. Auburn-Clemson was week one, and Auburn didn't really necessarily live up to the hype early, although they too came on late. But this is one that I think, even for the loser, I think it's very realistic to expect them to run the table and still find themselves in the national championship game, or in the Final Four college football playoff national championship hunt, I should say. And obviously for the winner, they'll have a leg up, you know, on the competition early. So I think that this game is very much going to deliver on the hype. But even more than that, I also think it's the kind of game where I don't think that it necessarily precludes the loser from being in the college football playoff conversation either.
Do you think that the committee could possibly go 1-2 just for the marketing standpoint, and if these teams meet in the playoffs, to say, you know, just kind of for what it would mean because they're playing each other, they end up at 1-2? If
do you
that makes
mean
sense.
Like when the playoff field is announced later, or just for the poll purposes?
Well, no, for the poll purposes for week one, do you think the committee could say, okay, we have Alabama and Florida State playing, let's put Florida State and Alabama at 1-2 to help market the game?
Well, let's remember the AP poll is obviously, you know, media members. And so, you know, I don't think the media really cares, you know, one way or the other. It doesn't help their bottom line in any way, shape, or form for the game to be 1-2. And so I don't think so, but I also just think the Ohio State hype is real. Like I said, I seem to be the only one that remembers how abysmal that offense was to end last season. I was actually at the college football playoff game when they just got smoked by Clemson 31-0. But I just think, to answer your question, I don't think that really matters in the eyes of the voters. I think they're going to vote for who they believe are the best teams. And I also think, let's be honest, a lot of media members are very thin-skinned, and, you know, they don't want the scorn of Ohio State fans for having the audacity not to put them at 1-2. So I think it'll be 1-3, but it's not going to take away from the on-the-field matchup. And I'll tell you this, if I was just picking two teams to play for the national championship in the last game of the season, independent of everything else, it would be these two teams that are going to be playing the first weekend in Atlanta.
Outside of Ohio State, and maybe outside of what we might expect to be the top five, top ten, are there any teams that you look at as sleepers that are kind of going under the radar right now?
Oh, it's a great question. You know, I'll tell you this, you know, when you talk about Ohio State, well, actually, let me backtrack. I think Oklahoma State's going to be really good, and I saw Sports Illustrated, I think, had them at number 5 or number 6, and they're the only place that really has Oklahoma State really high. I actually like them a lot. You know, they returned basically all of their offense, and they were better on defense than people realize. And I'm also just not sold on that cross-state rival Oklahoma being good this year, or meeting expectations this year, I should say, with a first-year head coach who's the youngest coach in college football. And, oh, by the way, they lost a lot of talent off last year's team, Joe Mixon, Samaje Perine, D.D. Westbrook, the wide receiver. So I think the combination of Oklahoma State being a little worse than people expect and Oklahoma State being a little better, that to me leads me to believe that Oklahoma State could be good. The other team that I'm really intrigued by, I don't know if they'll be like significantly better, But Michigan is you know, Michigan is such a fascinating team because, you know, for all the flack that Harbaugh's gotten, they've won 10 games each of his first 2 years. What's going to be interesting this year is they are a very, 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 very young team coming into the year, but they've also had back-to-back top five recruiting classes. So I don't know where they'll end up. Obviously, we know how good the Big Ten East is, but I'm just more than anything intrigued to kind of see, you know, just how they look, and not even necessarily week one or week two, and obviously they open with Florida, but more than that, just how they look over the course of the season. They're a team that strikes me as they're going to continue to get better each and every year, each and every week, excuse me. As I said, they have a lot of young talent, but yes, a lot of talent nonetheless.
And you mentioned that Florida game yesterday. Jim McElwain suspended Antonio Callaway, six other players, for anywhere from what could be a mild misunderstanding to some credit card fraud. We don't really know. What do you think the fallout is from that on McElwain in that first week game, which could end up being Florida's season decided game?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because for as intrigued as I am by Michigan, I also just kind of think that Florida, to me, like, there's a little too much hype. And I think Florida actually opened as about a 3-point favorite in this game. And it's now up to Michigan, I believe, by about 4 after yesterday's suspension. And I don't think that's as much an indication of Antonio Callaway having that much impact as it is just the idea that, you know, I don't know that Florida's good. I think that the guys in Vegas got it wrong, and I think the bettors kind of tipped them off with how much money was coming in on Michigan. You know, with Florida, outside of the Antonio Callaway news, let's not forget that this is a team that's basically won 2 straight SEC East championships almost exclusively because of their defense, and they had 7 guys off that defense drafted last year. So while they're always going to have talent at Florida, they're going to be really young. So I don't know that the Callaway thing really impacts them against Michigan that much, because for me personally, I thought they were a little bit overhyped coming into the year. Now, to your guys' point, if this is something that is a continued thing, and we're going to find out some details, you know, Jim McElwain's statement on Sunday didn't really seem to indicate that it was going to be a long-term, you know, season-long suspension or anything like that. But you know, if this thing carries on, then I do think it could impact them once you hit SEC play, when you got the Georgias, the LSUs, teams like that on the schedule.
Were you surprised McElwain suspended Callaway for this game?
No. I mean, look, I mean, you know, as you guys said, even if it's a minor, you know, transgression, it is still in some way, shape, or form a fraud. You know, it is still fraud, I should say. I don't know that it's going to reach the level of the kid that got suspended from Florida State, where, I mean, he's facing felony charges. I mean, that kid from Florida State's probably never going to play it down in major college football again. But it is a very serious offense, and obviously it wasn't just Callaway, it was 6 of his other teammates. We're going to find out the severity of it, you know, but no, I'm not surprised at all. I think, if anything, it could get a lot worse, but it'll be interesting to see how that thing plays out over the next couple weeks.
And we're talking to Aaron Torres of Fox Sports Radio and FanRag Sports. Aaron, looking at the rest of the SEC, it seems like they've taken a step back in regard to their impact in college football. Is that a good thing for college football, having, you know, the Big Ten, Big 12 start to kind of take the forefront and SEC take a step back?
Yeah, you guys, I don't know if you saw last week, I did a big column on FanRag about how I believe that Nick Saban's basically killed SEC football. yeah, I mean, so many great coaches, you know, you just can't get over the hump with Nick Saban. And so, you know, guys like Les Miles and Mark Richt have been forced out. You know, Kevin Sumlin, Gus Malzahn on the hot seat this year. So, you know, I totally agree. You know, I did a ranking this morning of the best conferences in college football entering the year. I had the SEC at number 2. I think you could really make a compelling case that it's number 3 or 4 behind the ACC and the Pac-12. I have it behind the Big Ten. So to answer the question more specifically, you know, look, I always think in sports it's good when you have something, be it a conference, a division, that is head and shoulders above the rest, because it just creates a conversation. And then what ends up happening is you spend the whole season arguing, is the SEC really that much better than everyone else? Are the Warriors that much better than everybody else? Is LeBron really? But, you know, like, it creates conversation. What I do think is really interesting, though, is I think what has been good for college football is the implementation of TV money has created so much parity in this sport, and it has allowed other schools to kind of step up to the plate and compete with the SEC. What I think really is the most interesting thing is that as kind of what I said, with the money increasing and also with the coaches a bit more spread out, I think what you've seen is the SEC model go to other conferences. So Urban Meyer, I think, brought that to the Big Ten, where he came in and, you know, if you guys remember back to his first recruiting class, and I think it was 2013, the year he got Zeke Elliott and Joey Bosa, you know, he really challenged the coaches in that conference to step up to the plate. Now you have Jim Harbaugh with, as I mentioned, you know, top five recruiting class in back-to-back years. James Franklin has things rolling at Penn State. Then you go across the country, Jimbo Fisher at Florida State, Dabo Sweeney at Clemson have kind of created the same kind of vibe. So anyways, I'm saying all this to say I think it's I think having the SEC dominate is bad for college football, or I think it's bad that they're not as good as they once were, but I also think it's good that the coaching talent has kind of spread out, where now you have a Harbaugh and a Urban Meyer in the Big Ten. You have, of course, you know, Dabo and Jimbo Fisher in the ACC, Chris Peterson in the Pac-12. I just think that is good for college football, where now the concentration of coaching and of kind of true contenders isn't necessarily all in the SEC.
And how about, I can think of at least one non-Power 5 team people are going to look at this year, and that's Wyoming. A lot of people have Josh Allen at the top of next year's NFL draft. I've seen him in Heisman conversations. What kind of exposure is he going to get this year? Is he going to be able to put himself on a Heisman stage? Are we looking at a Kellen Moore, Boise State kind of thing with him, or are they just going to kind of be on the back burner until bowl season?
Well, I'll tell you this. They open at Iowa this year. So, you know, Iowa is a team that if you remember a few years ago lost to North Dakota State. It might have actually been last year. I can't really remember. But they lost to North Dakota State. So they're not infallible to these, you know, kind of smaller school upsets. And, of course, North Dakota State used to be coached by Craig Bohl, who is now the head coach at Wyoming. You know, I think obviously if Josh Allen goes into, you know, Iowa City and pulls off that upset, and I do think in Vegas' eyes it would be an upset, then he will throw himself into the Heisman conversation, in assuming that he plays, you know, kind of up to expectations. But I do think that it's so hard for any player from a non-Power 5 school to stay in that conversation. You know, you mentioned Kellen Moore, and it's a great example of just how hard it is. That was a team and a program that was, you know, for 4 years they basically never lost. And then really specifically that last year, if you remember, they opened up, or 1 year they opened up with a big win against Virginia Tech. I think 1 year they maybe beat Georgia. I can't remember all the details now, but you know, it's just so hard because week in and week out, the spotlight's not on you. And then you have the fans from the Big Ten, from the SEC saying, you know, how good is the competition? So I think because of the draft stature, people will be paying attention to him. As far as like a Heisman Trophy race, that feels a little tough for me just because you're just not going to have enough signature games. By the way, I would add, I think Quentin Flowers, the quarterback from South Florida, he's going to have the same difficulty. He's going to be putting up a lot of great stats against a lot of bad teams, and the question just becomes, based on the competition level, if he himself can play himself in the Heisman Trophy race as well.
Do you think Allen's legit? Where would you rank him among the quarterbacks this year?
You know, look, I think, you know, my whole thing is this, and so I take a little bit of a different approach to kind of evaluating quarterbacks, right? So, like, this was a big conversation I had on Fox Sports Radio a few nights ago. I was hosting our national show the night that Deshaun Watson made his debut with the Houston Texans. And obviously, Deshaun Watson looked awesome, and, you know, Texans fans are really excited. And my co-host was a huge Jets fan, and he was really mad that the Jets didn't take Deshaun Watson. And I said to him, I said, here's my thing with quarterbacks. Do you elevate your college program to a level that it's never been before? And that sounds like a stupid thing, right? Like, college success doesn't always translate to the NFL. How many Heisman Trophy winners have we had that never made it in the NFL? You know, Matt Leinart, Tim Tebow, you name it. But what I would add is this, is that if you look at basically every great quarterback in the NFL right now,
they elevated their college program to a place that it had never been before, right? So Aaron Rodgers takes Cal to a place that it had never been. They were competing with USC for Pac-10 titles at the time. Russell Wilson walks onto the campus of Wisconsin. Within 2 weeks, is voted a captain by his teammates, takes Wisconsin to a Big Ten title. Marcus Mariota, who I think we all agree is one of the rising young stars, takes Oregon to the brink of a national championship. Drew Brees takes Purdue to a Big Ten title, which seems insane kind of in this day and age, right? So, you know, you can add maybe down the road Deshaun Watson to the mix, Derek Carr, who was phenomenal at Fresno State. So I say all this to say, and then, oh, by the way, there's the inverse of that. Jared Goff was good, but not, you know, you never watched Jared Goff at Cal and said, that guy is a sure, you can't miss NFL prospect, right? And now right. He's really struggling in the NFL. And you have other guys like that. You know, I remember watching Blaine Gabbert at Missouri and the same thing. So I say all that to say that I just have, you know, I want to see Josh Allen do that at the college level. Everybody knows how good he is. Everybody knows what the expectations are. And yeah, if he takes, you know, Wyoming and puts them on his back and goes 11-1, then yeah, I think that, you know, it would make me feel differently if he put up, you know, good stats on a not good team. And, you know, because so many of these draft prospects now, they're evaluated not just what they do on the field, but of course off the field as well. And they have the frame and they have the this and they have the that. I need to see it on the field, especially at the quarterback position, because the one thing about quarterback that we know is that if you're a high first-round draft pick, whether you want to be or not, whether your coach wants you or not, you are going to be forced into action early on in your NFL career. So like I said, I need to see a little bit more from Josh Allen to make me feel good about him. I would probably have him right there with Josh Rosen at number two behind Sam Darnold, but I think it's going to be a fun conversation to have all season long.
My last question, it's a little off topic, but obviously Fox Sports ditching kind of writing in general, going completely audio-visual. And I won't ask you to comment directly on that, but this kind of seemed to be a trend in sports media. As a journalist, what are your thoughts on this change in sports media?
It's really funny, you know, obviously it was a tough situation at Fox, but I can't speak for everybody else there, but, you know, there were signs, you know, writing on the wall that they were maybe trending this direction. I was a little surprised by the timing of it, because Fox is going to have its best set of college football games ever with Michigan, Ohio State, USC, Texas, Ohio State, Penn State. And so to go completely away from writing was a bit surprising to me, but, you know, that was the decision they made, and you know, that's life. It's interesting, in general, I kind of feel like, you know, there was maybe a little bit of a saturation point in writing where, and obviously a lot, myself included, a lot of great writers lost their jobs, and I'm sympathetic to anybody who loses their job. It's never easy, and thankfully I've been able to bounce back and find a few things for both football and basketball season, which I think are going to, you know, help me get through. But, you know, it's funny to look at all these places and you wonder, do you really need, you know, 10, 12 full-time college football writers? Do you really need all these people covering all of these sports, NBA, NFL, or can you make do with less? So I think that what this is going to do is it's going to kind of show who kind of the cream of the crop is. And I always think that there's going to be a place for good writing, a place for good reporting, some combination of both, you know. And then I also am curious to see how this whole thing works with audio and video. You know, it's easy to say that this is where the trends are going, this is where the market is going, but you wonder if in 5 years maybe there will be an oversaturation of video as well. I don't have all the answers. You know, I'm firmly a guy that I believe that if you continue to work hard, if you continue to put out a good product, people will notice it, people will appreciate it, and I certainly hope that's the case, because I know you guys are young guys in our field, and I still consider myself pretty young too, even though I'm in my 30s. And I like to cover sports for a lot longer, but I always think there's going to be a place for good writing, and, you know, we'll find out over the next couple of years, but I sure hope so.
His name is Aaron Torres. You can hear him on Fox Sports Radio. You can read him at fanrag.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Aaron_Torres. Aaron, thanks so much for coming on. Looking forward to week one.
Appreciate you guys having me. Anytime you need me, just call.
All right, so that's going to do it for us this week. Next week, I will be in the land of Pablo Sandoval, caught in his gravitational orbit. So we're still trying to figure out what we're going to do.
There's going to be a solar eclipse on the West Coast, too.
There always is. So it will be Lebowitz, maybe intern Mitch in here. We should let him do it.
No, I want to do it with him, yeah.
We're waiting to hear back. But hey, you can follow us on Twitter. Keep up with all of it at Calling It Podcast. Follow on SoundCloud as well. Subscribe on iTunes. Another preseason game this week, another Red Sox-Yankees series, so it's pretty much just going to be a repeat next week. Same stuff.
It'll be great.
All right, Alex will talk to you then, and perhaps Mitch as well. So for me, for 2 weeks, for them until next week, thank you for listening. My name is Alex Barth. This has been Calling It, brought to you by Snap Call Sports.
You've been listening to Calling It. This episode has been brought to you by Snap Call Sports. Snap Call, the game within the game. Available for iPhone or Android.